employees, entrepreneurs, Dr. Lockwood being our last interview, and it's the first should be last, and the last should be first. I forget who said that. Clearly, the challenge of interviewing Dr. Frank Lockwood is going through his, not his resume, but his book of resumes, okay, where he transcends outrageous academic experience, including things like to flip or not to flip. That's a wonderful conversation using a family limited proprietorship on harvesting strategy. I mean, how wonderful can that be? Crucial to my personal experience. When to let go and get the most out of, you know, day two, the fraud investigation, detective agency, entrepreneurship theory and practice, and I'm just mentioning a few, to presentations such as, again, maximizing the harvest, which is really so important, an art as well as a science, by challenging a C, changing it to a C corporation from an LLC when selling to new owners. I mean, to, you know, stuff like that that I needed in the past, it probably cost me $1 billion not having him send me the paper prior to my sale. So he's responsible for a lot of money I've lost. And to, the giving part of Frank's paperwork, opening doors through community college articulations and entrepreneurship, probably completely break fuse stuff in 2008. And then his honors, I mean, I can only paste like 18 pages here, which if we went through the whole thing, would probably be a good interview, but not. We're going to have to get into them. And especially what we're going to do is get into some of the things that he hasn't done into and keeping secret. As honors, a president of Sam Walton, Trent Fellow, Ben and Kim, Sigma, alphabet aside, student business fraternity, best entrepreneurship educator award. How good does it get? I'm not even going to bother the chancellor's evaluation of how great he is. Best paper from the Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship, 32nd annual conference. Imagine being the best paper. I'm going to go back to his university experience in Tallahassee, Berry College, transcending, and then his capability of grants, and it's interesting the grants that he chose to. I think it says a lot about Frank, about his, you know, online graduate certificate in science and technology, entrepreneurship. That's what he's torturing me with right now. And the Bonner Foundation, it's about students in the entrepreneurship program. I mean, following up on that, things seem to go in sequence with Frank. And then, to the impressive, W.K. Kellogg Foundation grant for 2005-2007, $2 million. WC, again, $153,000. That's great. And then, come on. How do you beat the project manager for NASA Technology Incubator Grant of 1999, where the Technological Research and Development Board, $300,000 awarded for the development of a technology business incubator? Well, that makes Frank a rocket scientist. I think that his military experience, which will you stop kicking me, please? I have Sergeant, you wrote war plans. How many people will I ever meet in my life that wrote war plans? I would love to see them.
Yeah, the shot.
Maybe that's
it. Intelligence work. That's what I wrote.
My God.
They call strike out, which is now the rapid deployment force that they has done in Fort Bragg.
Wow. And they're still utilizing these.
Oh, I'm sure they're recuperating the remote.
That's serious stuff. Then his adventures into actually owning and running companies, first in venture capital from 1983 to 1986 as a principal of strategy company, where he analyzed business plans, conducted due diligence, negotiated investment, oversaw performance of clients, in consultants, Reliance Aviation Industry, then he worked with the Florida Department of Children and Families, evaluating the South Florida State Hospital, which was a little $750 million project, and then showing and demonstrating his interest in something environmental. The Tomorrow Conspiracy for Promise and Tropical Forest shows a give back tendency, clearly a give back tendency on Frank's part from 1995 to the present. And I'm sure there is just a give back of, you know, that Kelly spoke of. And being the business incubator in February, the Advanced Technology Business Development Center in Tallahassee, project manager, interface TRDA, the NASA Incubator Grant. I mean, you know, and the We Train Technology is a great name. It's that, you know, November 2001-2003, established a managing company administrative functions, including personnel, soup to nuts, stuff, and raised successfully $7 million in venture funding for this group, in publishing, and insurance is very interesting. He actually did participate in check on technology, Dr. Lau, all the time. And the Patriot Health Companies, he was chairman of the board and principal, founding the company, organized the holding company, organized the Patriot Service, a successful startup. He then went to again related Patriot Life Insurance, where a company where he became the president, obviously as a result of being successful there. Modern Pioneers Life Insurance Company, president there. Patriot Life, president there. Shop Contents, principal. And then he's developing a new healthcare, a new healthcare concept. In banking, Frank jumps into First City, Citibank Corp of Texas, and he takes a stint with East Tennessee Bank Corp as the director and principal. Once again, director and principal is the worst position of the ball. And from June of 83 to 85, really started the business. He's a startup business, and then he's an investor in Pontiac State business, and but very active, not just as an investor. And he goes to Badger Trading Company as president and principal. And he is very interesting. He organized a capitalized management firm as well as recruited sales force, which is very, is a jump from a lot of the things he does. You know, the sales function is different from a lot of things that he did, but his obviously goes to his complete versatility, and as Dr. Lam would say, his civil like abilities. He goes to the, he becomes a, from April of 1979 during this stuff to from high-tech exchangers, et cetera. Inhalation therapy, in preparation for his bureaucratic experience in other universities, and equity patent. Here he actually participates in trade shows. I mean, that trade shows is the bottom line of Burroughs' businesses. He has a mining ventures, general partner. All right, so I mean, here you have this guy who's transcending so much. And usually, about 10 minutes ago, on most interviews, I then go to introducing Dr. Frank Lockwood, which I wanted to do as an entrepreneur and entrepreneur and teacher. And, you know, rather than me talking about you, what you did in your resume, perhaps you could tell us about more focused manner, both personally and professionally, about yourself.
Anymore.
Not more professional, but talk about yourself personally and professionally. And perhaps quickly focus on, go back to your interests, okay, which I said to probe about. Frank's research interests include entrepreneurship and small business strategy, formulation, and implementation. And your research interests may say some of the things that you want to talk about. Business policy, stakeholder strategies, ethics issues, entrepreneurial education for incarcerated prisoners, which I may become evidence course, international business issues, including business environment analysis, marketing. Talk a little bit about yourself. I'm already overwhelmed.
I've had a lot of fun. I have obviously very wide interests, and when opportunities came my way, I was able to delve into some of them and develop companies that created jobs and wealth. I added in my 20s. I had always had a yen to do what I'm doing now, which is to be a university professor. Entrepreneurs, I think, have a need to work and mentor other entrepreneurs. That's one of the characteristics that makes us different from people that work for other people in existing businesses. I was a history major at Ripon College. I had no business training at all. When I left the 101st Airborne, I went to Emory University because my best friend and fraternity brother was going there. Because he had to take the GMAT exam in Saigon, and when he came back, he found his two-thirds of his platoon killed, and the rest were injured. And I've only talked to him twice since then. But I went, and I got an old MBA, not the stuff we do today. I have a major in finance, minor in accounting. I got to Wall Street. I'm a Smith Barney alum by meeting a guy from Goldman Sachs on an elevator. And instead of going to a conference and listening to somebody talk about real estate, we went up to his suite and drank a bottle of Old Crow, and he told me about investment banking. And so I went to Wall Street. I didn't know it, but I turned out to be a really good salesperson. 4 days, 8 hours and 32 minutes to sell my first share of stock. And that was pretty stressful. But I stuck it through. And as I was, I became disenchanted with selling stock. I thought it, I still do think it's an intellectually dishonest business because you don't buy stock back from people, you just sell it to them. And then these people are using your expertise for your recommendations, but they don't have any expertise to sell stuff that they've got because there's not enough money for a registered rep to buy stock back from the customers. So I got into the active management of the bond business for a group of us in Chicago that came up with the concept. And I went back to New York City and traded on the bond desk because that's how I always like to learn what's going on.
Yeah, but not to back Wall Street, have
you? No. But I... we'll see what they do. I think it's about time we have some on the side, Lloyd. So anyway, I came back to the Chicago offices with Barney after about a year. My lifelong friend and neighbor and his partner and I decided to start our own bond firm, which we did, called the Barrington Trading Company. It's still going today. It's called Arbor Trading. It's probably the most successful off Wall Street bond trading operation, and they would basically trade corporate government bonds. And I got bored with that business and started.
What's that trade of an entrepreneur?
I'm a serial entrepreneur. As you can tell what you've gone through here, I started a whole bunch of companies. When they get up against the sustainable company that you eventually harvest the domain of all the other businesses working for somebody else in an existing business. We use a lot of the same words. We apply them differently. That's the difference there. So there's a real, they are two separate domains. Somebody who has worked for somebody else in the existing business, I don't believe can teach entrepreneurship. I think you have to experience it. I also have a problem. I don't think I can teach in a regular college of business because I've shied away from working for people in existing businesses. I don't understand the politics of working in an existing business. I certainly understand a lot of the concepts because the training that I've had in my MBA program and at South Carolina with my doctorate, those programs were focused on working for, were not entrepreneurship focused.
But don't you think that what I call entrepreneurs often act like entrepreneurs?
Well, they are, very much so. The environment is so different. The hardest part about being an entrepreneur is getting somebody who's going to champion your idea so you can get through all the politics that exist within an organization.
I think you'll enjoy my interviews. In the search, in my major in psychology, of course, and I have a search for causal or correlative commonality and on how people like you become who you are. And I'd like to look a little bit at your childhood experiences. So if you can lie down on that couch, like I'll turn into Sigmund Freud and we'll go through the varying psychosexual situational stuff. But not really. Let's describe your behavior and define your childhood peer groups.
Well, I grew up in a town 50 miles west of Chicago called Barrington, Illinois. Folks who lived in the south of the Chicago Northwestern Railroad tracks were extremely wealthy. Barrington Hills is a village that's right next to the village of Barrington. That's one of the 10 wealthiest villages in the United States. So I grew up with kids that had little money and kids that had a lot of money. So I got to play tennis courts and ride horses and so on, and then I would clean up the tennis courts and shovel out the stalls because that's all I got to go do that. But I didn't suffer from any not having a lot of money. My dad was a patent attorney. We had
most entrepreneurs, you're answering questions that are down with the list.
Okay.
I'm trying to define you're already predicting the questions and answering them. Your peer group. But there were some people are alone. I mean,
I played athletics all the way through. I was a high jumper on a track team. I went downstate in the high rolls when I was a senior. I was a captain of the track team. I was on student council. I was the president of the Barrington Christian Youth Fellowship. I've always been in a leadership role. I like to do that.
Really competitive.
I'm very competitive. But I also have feelings for the people that I'm competing against. The town that I grew up in, the school system, was one of the, at the time that I did, it was one of the top 10 school districts in Illinois. One of the things I got to do was they split my class in half. I got to do the experimental part, taking the University of Illinois special math course. So I've never had traditional math training. I started out with A plus B equals B plus A, went all the way through calculus in high school. And I think I'm reasonably intelligent. I've always loved to read. I was at
organized. You organize yourselves?
But I also played organized sports whenever was available. And my summers, I spent my summers in Canada at a boys' camp. That's allowed me to have a very great time in the outdoors. I've been doing that some day.
So you see the difference between the 5 to 12 area and the 12 to 16 area. How did your peers perceive you?
They elected me in leadership positions.
Yes, you were.
I was the second person in my class to get my varsity letter in high school. I had a girlfriend, you know, that was part of the popular song.
But you could relate to the monkey out of the stalls as well, right?
Oh yeah, that's what I had to do.
It's called the worth ethic worker, not the worth energy, the importance of the work ethic. What were your favorite activities as a kid?
Reading, socializing, and athletics for sure.
What was your attitude towards authority figures in your life? And do you know why?
So long as I don't think that the leadership person is being stupid or greedy, I'm willing to follow along. I did try to affect leadership because I was had a fair amount of income. I was able to put money where I wanted to. Help get people elected locally and nationally, I followed the laws.
I think the key being your first four words, and as long as.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was a qualified attitude. Were you distracted as a kid, 12 to 16, found daydreaming, did you have big ideas? If so, can you share them or keep them to yourself?
I don't recall any big ideas. The 50s were a totally different time to grow up than we are now. We had new things. We had new things, new technologies, television. I was never, I got every fall I would get a new set of clothes for school, and that was it. You know, I didn't have a lot of money, but I always had enough. I had three sisters, been very loving, still do, loving family. My parents were both very smart, well educated. They demanded that my sisters and I all excel at school.
What kind of jobs did they have?
My dad was a patent attorney. He was dad. My dad was a bit of a fundamentalist. My mother, who had three master's degrees in theology, was a very smart woman, also a great athlete. She lettered in Northwestern. Was a big school. So fairly, was pretty open to thinking about different ways of approaching things. We grew up in a town that had five Jewish families, about 30% Catholic, the rest Protestant. We had one black family that lived with the Paulson family, Hank Paulson, who was the former secretary of the treasury and so on. I used to ride the school bus with Hank, and they were Mormon. So it was, I grew up without having any prejudices. I still love them. I judge people on how they treat me more than anything else. I'll never forget one of the things we did. When I was on the student council, we decided to do an exchange program with one of the black high schools in Chicago. And their student council came to our high school first, and they came on a train. And when they got off the train, their eyes were just wild. They were scared to be in an environment that they'd never been in, an all-white community. And we had a wonderful time. And then about a month later, we went down to their high school, and our eyes were wide open because there we were the only, only white folks in 3,000 or 4,000 black folk. We had a wonderful time. And we talked about things.
That's when things you could have a wonderful time.
Yeah.
But you clearly weren't out here with the beaver. No. I want to answer that distraction question and that idea of thinking of kind of outside the box. Let's go back to your professional experiences. And I'm not going to ask you to give me some examples because you've done too many, but some important to you. The challenge in facing maybe your first company or your company of your choice.
Challenging, boy.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Let's see. The first company that I did was this Equity Pet. And,
Equity Pet
Inc.
That's not on your resume.
Yeah, it is.
I know you're not.
It's the last one. First, you talked about it.
I did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Equity Pet was, we had three of us at Smith Barney. That were selling in the Chicago office, and I was the first non-Ivy leader to be hired by the Chicago office at Smith Barney. One of my friends had a customer that had in Michigan that had a plastic wool molding business, and Andy came back with this prototype of a new fish tank, and so we got together. We figured out that we could manufacture fish tanks at about a quarter of the cost of the existing company called Metaframe. They had about 90% of the fish tank business, and so we tried it just as a win to see if we could do it. We set up a shop in Chicago. We hired a gentleman up in Chicago. He has a lot of folks from Poland. So we hired an all-Polish workforce. And we started making fish tanks. And the team were able to sell them. We had the effect of that fish tank design put Metaframe out of business in about 18 months.
Really?
Yeah. And the trade show that you alluded to, that's not the only trade show that I've been to with my companies, but that was, we built a 300-gallon fish tank. We hired buy the fish tanks, put in the fish tanks, the aerator, the gravel, the plastic plants, and all that kind of stuff, and sell the fish. And don't get any money from the fish tank. Just get money for all the parts that you put into it. So people can walk out of the store carrying a 5 or 10 or 15 gallon fish tank with all the junk in it. And that is what caught on with the hobby, with the pet shops. And so
you use that distribution and the ability to upsell. It's kind of like leaving the shop, buying a dress but not getting the coat. Loading the coat with it.
So the hobby shop, the fish store made substantially more money by giving the fish tank away. But they can buy the fish tank for so cheap,
right,
that they were happy to do it. It was a good bundle promotion. And we ended up giving the company to the workers and so forth today.
Buy five, get one.
Yeah.
Got the 5 acre margins on it.
Yeah.
It sounds like you thought through those things very well. And we'll go back to some real challenges. You made it sound so easy and logical, but
it is once you see it.
Yeah. Well, that's bad. We'll get back to something much more challenging. When problems arose, how did your typical management team or you resolve
directly? As quickly as I could.
The flame fire and the flame throw and the flame dumpster in the back.
I mean, it's, I don't know if you're particularly dealing with people, if you don't deal directly and transparently with people, the problem will fester and get out of hand and become far worse. And I'd rather know that I've got a losing proposition early rather than spend time, energy, and resources trying to save something that can't be saved.
Something I don't think I was really good at.
I don't know if that's just something.
I mean, attacking the problem, yes.
Yeah.
But it wasn't my strength to hire people because I used to hire them for what they could be rather than what they are. And hang on to them too long. This is my weakness.
I always tried to hire somebody to manage the people for me. But I always had, I kept a 3x5 card system, red, green, and white. Red for bad comments, green for good comments, white for just actions and events and things that people did. And so I had my personnel file in my drawer. So the hardest thing to do for me was to fire somebody. The first time I had to fire somebody, I couldn't do it. One of my partners did it. And it was for pretty gross insubordination. And I just couldn't do it. But then I learned how to fire people.
Firing people was a very horrible experience for me too.
And I did it being very direct. I would sit somebody down in my office and I'd say, after this interview, you no longer will work at my company. If you'd like to discuss the reasons why, I'm happy to do that. We're going to go to your desk, we'll clean your desk out, and here's some boxes to put your things in, and we'll take your boxes out from your car, and we'll give you your last paycheck, and wish you well.
Frank, you just transited from a very benign, brilliant, give-back entrepreneur to a very cruel,
not at all.
Yeah, not cruel, but a very direct force about to be reckoned.
consequences.
Well, it demonstrates how dominant that you could be a chameleon and wear different hats, both urging people on to their excellence and at the same time ending things so there would be no pain in a no-nonsense manner.
A problem that I have to solve. I grew up with three sisters and a fairly feminist mother. So. And that's had a big effect on me. I love working with women. I think they are more naturally entrepreneurial than men are. I think that they assess risk. Testosterone it causes us males to skip over some very important issues. But also, having companies where you have a bunch of women have difficulty working with each other.
Does this sound familiar?
It's not a myth. It's true.
And women. You don't know how familiar. Women can multitask better.
Yeah.
Accomplish more in the present day,
focus,
and more focus. I understand that there's a boomer in line, okay, they all pick them 3-1. They are catty and can start messing around with each other.
Yeah,
okay. But other than that, give me a woman any day of the week.
I agree.
I was a reverse chauvinist at the end of my career, really.
So, anyway, I had a situation where I had, along with my partner, acquired 5 regional publications for RV owners and enthusiasts. And we consolidated the operations down to Florida. And so I went from 5 art departments to 1 art department, 5 editorial departments to 1 editorial department. I kept the sales force across the eastern half of the U.S. However, I made them all male. I wasn't interested in being responsible for a woman being on the road. I just didn't want to do that. I know that's a little bit different, but it's...
No, it's not different.
Exactly.
I'm surprised because women... In my experience, make the best salespeople.
Yes, but I didn't want to be responsible for a mother being on the road away from her family, or a single young lady being exposed to the potential dangers that can happen on the road.
Okay.
So anyway, the art department that I had. They came to me and they said that they would like to have some music in their art department that would improve productivity. And I think that's probably true.
Absolutely.
So I went out and bought a really nice stereo system and installed it in the art department and bought a whole bunch of, not LPs, but the, I'm dating myself with those
CDs.
Not CDs, before CDs, the
cassettes.
8-track cassettes.
8-track, okay.
And about a week later, the productivity in the art department started going downhill.
Was the music?
Yeah. And so I asked Lori, the head of my art department, said, what's going on? And she said, well, the girls can't agree on what music needs to be played. And I said, okay, so how are we going to resolve this? Because we just spent all this money on this. She said, well, I don't know, so we got all the girls together. So we decided that we would come up with a rotating calendar, and then and we would do it for 2-hour stints. And so each person got to select the kind of music they wanted for their 2-hour stint. Well, that didn't work out. And the all of a sudden it went from an art department that was meeting its objectives to one that was in trouble. And the girls, some of the girls were getting so upset they wanted to quit and leave. And that I couldn't have, so I came up with what I turned out to be an innovative solution. I went out and bought them each a Walkman. And I gave them some money to buy their own CDs in the productivity shop with.
But you identify
the problem.
In specific. Identification.
Yeah.
Realization of it.
Oh, gosh. If you don't have the capability of identifying something early on, the odds of you being staying in business diminish further rapidly. And that's true not only internally, but externally.
The Advil you found required emanates from.
I think perhaps we should take a
Retreat
break.
Okay.
Well, we should maybe stop this.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're recording.
Okay. So, you now have to understand that I now have another witness to the litigation that we made for you proceeding. I've taken 3 ibuprofen in the presence of emergency in my cup in the presence of Dr. Lockwood, just for FYI. When somebody joins your company, how do you orient them quickly?
A lot of the companies that I was involved with, we created a management team when we went into it. We did not bring in a lot of investors as we went along.
Employees.
And just hiring employees. I learned after about the third or fourth company I had that you should have a written employee manual.
Right. Okay.
And I had a key employee that I would attach to the new employee. And I would delegate authority to my existing employee that they had the task of bringing that new person into the company, and they had to report back to me how it was going. And then I would also talk to the new employee to find out what their impressions were.
How do you motivate more people, Dr. Lockwood?
Setting specific goals, and probably one of the harder things that I had to learn was how to delegate authority. And if you delegate authority the right way, it's a mutual agreement. I did it again very directly by setting specific goals, and if they accomplished their goals, we would have an agreed amount of reward. It could be a change in job, it could be a financial reward, it might be maybe a small ownership position in the company. I also learned that in order to establish whether a person accomplished their goal or not, you needed to have a set of metrics so you can determine on a non-subjective basis whether they accomplished their goal or not.
Did you find, this is a question that's not in my thing, but one of my challenges, the challenge of delegation versus abrogation?
Well, you know that you cannot delegate a responsibility. The responsibility, that word in Greek means responsible one's own ability. So you can get people to commit to do something, and you can get them to agree to be obligated.
Charger.
Hey, you want me to stop?
three times. Continue on is a very important subject because I made so many mistakes here myself.
Well, I think it's a learning process.
What you do is define the word responsibility again.
Responsibility means response to one's own ability. And so people misuse the word all the time. They're giving somebody a responsibility, can't do it. They can't accept the responsibility. If the right words are obligation and commitment. And so the people you ask them to be committed to doing something, and they're going to do that. And the other side of it is your obligation to for the quid pro quo. So that's what makes up delegation of authority in the hard way.
Yeah, but even then, the CEO can't just say, "Well, I delegated that authority to him. He failed, and therefore." You can't stop by fall. Delegating authority is a two-way process. The person that you're asking to do something, to make a commitment to do something, has to agree to make the commitment. And if they don't, and what I always had people do is I said, all right, this is what I would like to ask you to do. If you're willing to do it, you put that up over there, not there. If you're willing to do that, this is what the result will be. But I would then have the person repeat back to me what it is I asked them to do. And 99% of the time, it was not the same thing that I asked them to do. And so you needed. So it was always a conversation, a negotiation. So you both agreed that you both understood what it is that you were that the person was going to do, and at that point in time you could then set up the metrics so you could measure whether somebody was doing it or not. And if you couldn't do the metrics, if you couldn't measure what somebody was supposed to do, then you had not arrived at a clear understanding of the metrics.
You're talking about chronological metrics.
Or they had to do with accomplish a certain financial performance or whatever.
I don't know about chronology. Then you would talk about, did we achieve the metric, right?
I don't know if I would use the chronology, but in assessing whether the goal was, the commitment was met or not.
Right. When they saw in a time fashion, especially when you got freeze pops, that you got to deliver to Walmart in 3 months. Okay? So I had traumatic post-traumatic stress disorder from that.
I understand. It's hard to do, and particularly hard to do.
But I like the formula. You just come up with a nice formula.
It works.
But you better have... Well, I don't think I've heard that formula. Well, of course, I'm only in my second course. But I'm not clear that formula has been...
I'm not
dispersed.
I'm not. I don't think it has.
Well, it will be down.
No.
Selecting people to join your company, I think we've kind of talked about that. We have some specifics. How are things, how to join your company? But right now, your company is the Entrepreneurial Department of Western Canada at the University. And you've already answered the question whether you're downsizing, staying around. And, the funding for universities is such.
It's not a company. The university is not a company. It doesn't follow any of the standards of the norms of a company. It is a bunch of very smart people who don't know how to get along with each other all the time. They have very strong opinions about where they're going to go and what they want to do. And they're not always the same.
Well, that's because of the problem that it is run like a company.
It's not run like a company.
Right.
And it shouldn't be because it's not a company. We have this concept of the academic community. But that allows for innovations.
Mm-hmm. So somebody has a mixed bag.
Yeah.
As Charlie Taylor said about government
of like that funeral. While I'm here, I'd kind of like to get a better understanding of how it's like to work in your profession of teaching.
Okay.
University. I'm not sure this is relevant because these are entrepreneurial characteristics, innovation, organization, passion.
We do all of that in our program.
Yeah. In the entrepreneurial program.
In our program.
Right.
Yes, our program is different from any other program because we put things in it that we think are cutting edge, are interesting, and there are skills that are necessary to be successful. I think we approach the development of the curriculum by looking at our careers and the skills we had, looking and talking with our advisory board, the skills they had and the skills they bought. Our advisory board are active entrepreneurs. So we developed our curriculum, and from scratch, we did not adapt another curriculum. I came to Western Carolina. My first year here, I created six new courses. And believe me, that is a hell of a lot of work to do that. But I did it because I wasn't satisfied to teach a course that was in finance that was an entrepreneurial finance course. I wanted to teach finance from the entrepreneur's point of view. And that's totally different than working with a company that already has bank accounts and assets and lawyers and accountants and all that stuff. We've been able to be very entrepreneurial
creating courses.
Yeah.
So about expense reporting, planning, and production, right?
Oh, yeah. Then yes, and it's our performance gets measured on the number of students that not the number of students that we bring in, but the number of students that we retain and graduate. We have another metric beyond that that we use that we personally care about. That's how successful our graduates are once they get out. That to me is a real measure of how successful we've been.
Entrepreneurship can be taught.
Oh, I know it can be taught. There's absolutely no question about it.
You can teach an entrepreneur how to be a better entrepreneur.
Yeah, there's no question that that's true. If you sit down and look, we base our growth on about 250 skills. There's no way, unless you are just the odd exception, that you know and are facile on those 250 skills. And if you take our MBA program, take our ME program, most of the folks that are in the program have business experience. So you've got a framework in which to put some of these ideas. And that's why it's important to have somebody who has business experience. And so you need that framework. I'll never forget, I taught an MBA class at Western on leadership, and I asked and most of the students in the class were foreign students, and I asked them a question on the first day of class. I said, how many of you have ever worked for a bad boss? Not one hand went up in here. And I said, oh boy, how many of you have ever worked for a boss? Not one hand went up in here. I said, I have no way to teach you leadership. You have no frame of reference at all. How many of you have ever been a boss? Not one hand went up. They've been students. And the only authority figures they had was their parents or their teachers. And that's not it. So having experience, it's important to have a frame of reference so you can understand where you might be going.
What's a typical day in the life of an entrepreneurship professor?
I don't know, but what a typical measure is.
They're
all different. Mine is because most of what I do is online teaching. I spend most of the time sitting right here reading and responding to emails, Skyping people. out of the office.
Something I think the college could do more often. So kind of a, and really in Tuckaseegee, it just felt like an island.
It is true.
Separate island, but I've noticed that the entrepreneurial department has reached out beyond the island into things like the Banner Group of the Cowboy and Dillsborough.
We do a lot. And you mentioned one of those honors that I had that. That there was a recognition from Princeton about the outreach project that my students and I did, and businesses in the end recovered from the floods.
Yeah, and I read that, and I said, what was the Canton disaster? You got $10,000 for
the town of Canton was 19 feet underwater.
Oh.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, they all closed down. It was different from the normal way of doing it.
are to me. So, and their absolute attitude towards the student, that student being our customer. And that's, you know, it's not the faculty person who's a customer, it's a student. Let's see who. A guy named George M. Haskell Jr. George was the head of the training program at Smith Barney when I went there.
I mean, ultimately, you have to learn how to sell.
Well, yes.
Okay.
George was a very refined person. He served great martinis. He had a few vanity. Serve up a martini and he would spray the top of them with a lemon mist. It was outstanding. George was a personal friend of Haile Selassie. George himself, he could sell anything. He was the guy who sold the New York Port Authority municipal bonds when they first came out. This guy was a real name. So, and much of a very old man when I got to meet him. But he, a man of extremely high integrity, we had 21 of us that went through the training program together at Smith Barney. And half the program you went, rotated through different departments. The other half was in the classroom, which was, I want to say, was tougher than the MBA program I went through every but I spent hours with George because I've never sold before. Listening, telling me how to go about selling and importance of listening, importance of identifying what the need of the customer was, and then tying it to the product or service that you had. I learned all those things from George. And
I assume running out of clothes.
And, oh, yeah, I asked the order was his first thing out of his mouth.
That's correct. Yeah, I went straight through that. And I was taught as well after each real estate day by this teacher who just liked to teach. And he would make sure that 8 out of 10 times of walk-ins we would close.
Yeah.
What is the most crucial obstacles to your success and what caused them?
Obstacles to my success. Wow.
I mean, that's so successful that obviously you overcome them, but at the time you might not have thought that you could.
I had a lot of success, and I've not had a lot of obstacles that I have not been able to overcome.
That's what I just said.
Unless I decided that that the end game wasn't worth pursuing. And so I mean, I was willing to lop things off in midstream. If the premise that we were starting a business on failed to pass muster.
Well, maybe the obstacles were the premises were the most crucial obstacles.
Well, the other thing I learned on that if I didn't have a good vision of where we're going to end up, I would stop also.
Overcoming these obstacles, is there a formula that you continuously see?
I don't overcome it. I think you have to have a good idea. I think all good ideas can get funded. You have to present them, but they can get funded. And I don't care what kind of financial situation you find yourself in. If you really have a good idea that has real merit, they can end up creating real value. You can get it funded.
Even today.
Especially today. People are dying for good ideas today. There is a ton of money on the sidelines waiting to be invested.
We'll go back to that. Give me an example of failure. What caused it? Well, you've already said that at one point you said, I don't want to do this anymore. It's not going to go anywhere. You've had so many successes. I'm not going to ask you what you've learned from them. You've learned so many things. I have a list of time I've got to go over with you, I'm going to give you like a couple of personality types, you see this type of things I'm asking for. And this list actually goes to the interviewee afterwards. They check them off and they say, someone very important, extremely important, someone important, not so important.
Have you looked at the Carlton Index?
The TAT.
CARLAND index, it's online.
This may have incorporated some of them.
Is it 25? It was, good question, sir. The most cited paper in entrepreneurship was a paper by Carlton Foy. It was on the characteristics of an entrepreneur.
Well, let me read some of mine. I did about 25 off the top of my head myself, personality types, the improver, the advisor, the superstar, the artist, the missionary. Then you go to
what a gamut of personality types you run there.
Doing what you enjoy, taking what you do seriously, believe, plan every aspect of your business, and my book, plan your work and plan, building a rock solid reputation, being known to deliver a consistent basis, being a superior negotiator.
Go take a look at the Carlton
Foy
article.
All right. We will do that. Maintaining balance, must have vision, must have passion, must learn to be a great decision maker, blah, blah, blah.
What is a great decision maker?
I'm going to interview you. What is a great decision maker? I got my own ideas, but yeah,
well, this is sort of
if you'd like me to answer that, that would be
sure.
Congress, Dr. Lambs.
I don't care.
Okay. to me,
it's a conversation.
This is an interview, okay. And I'm being a good boy and trying to follow the protocol.
Okay.
For me, this is not fair, but I'll do it anyways. A great decision maker makes his decisions with a tremendous, with A, starting out with a vision, B, being able to say, be objective about that vision and say, let's do enough due diligence to make sure that this vision not only is related to an existing need or is not too far ahead of the consumer, and being able to conduct enough due diligence to see whether it's realistic to produce at a cost-effective basis, the correct price pointing, and if the distribution, on and on. It's a long answer.
I think
you've got three.
Yeah.
And why didn't you answer instead of letting me go?
I'm just interested to move
in here. Well, there's a lot of things that go into a great decision.
Well, I understand. But a great decision is a way, you're in effect goal setting. When you make a decision, you're making a decision that you're going to accomplish a goal. And to me, a goal has to be measurable. It's got to be believable. You've got to be able to, and it has to be controllable. You have to have enough of whatever is in the mix so you can actually affect the outcome. And that to me is what a great decision is. It's somebody whose ability to understand all three of those aspects of the decision is a great decision.
And even though I went on and on, they're all in those three. That's why he's the teacher, okay? And the condenser, okay? And that's why that's why he's the teacher. I'm a detail guy because
I'm not a detail guy.
When you go to a business plan,
I'm not a detail person.
But if you put that sign, which you just said, on your wall, that would be the greatest place for that thing.
Well,
that's the sign. Not my Ron sentence, but that sign is the guiding light.
But I didn't learn it as a teacher. I learned that.
Your experience.
My feet, yeah.
It's interesting to note that all, and this is why I respect them, all the teachers in the entrepreneurial department have been there, done that. Okay, if they have been there, done that, why would I follow them?
You would?
Not close. So give me the five most important entrepreneurs.
and abilities which you think affect your varying careers which allowed you to succeed?
I think you need to be creative and innovative. That's one. And you need to follow the Schumpeter rule, creative destruction. See something that other people don't see.
What did you call that rule?
Joseph Schumpeter.
Joseph was Schumpeter.
Schumpeter. Yes, that's an Austrian economist, and he taught at Harvard.
That's not his fault.
Well, but he wrote a paper in the 30s titled Creative Destruction, which is what entrepreneurship is all about. And an example that I cited in this discussion was that activity method. We creatively destroyed MetaFrame by replacing it with a more efficient, more affordable fish tank. So I think you have to be and to be innovative and creative, you've got to be inquisitive and willing to take in input from people. You cannot be everyone. It's got to be vital. You have to have high energy. You have to be willing to go into hyper-focus to the detriment of relations with your family and friends. Hyper-focus cost me my first marriage.
That's my first and second.
So it's being successful in it's not first intense. It's not always happy. You've got to be resilient. You've got to have a great network. Absolutely great network. That allows you to be resilient. One part of your network is down, the other part is up, and you've got it.
Explain that.
Well, if your network friends, you better have a big enough network where you've got friends that you haven't pissed off and want to talk to you.
Okay, Ben, thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
And you've got to be resourceful. I mean, that's one of the problems being an entrepreneurial student. Their market, your demographic market, is just a one person, where it is normally obvious to thousands or millions. I can piss off 100,000 people out of a million, and I don't care. Okay?
Yeah.
But now, if I show Dr. Wild, can I show Dr. Wild this as evidence in his court case? And, if I tick off Dr. Long or Dr. Boyd or whoever,
you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's awful.
But you see, I don't think that's true.
Explain that.
I think that my colleagues and myself are willing to evaluate your work based on the work, not whether we like you or not. Liking you is a in having a personal.
Well, I was even talking about my product. Just because somebody doesn't like my product doesn't mean it's not a great product.
But there's not a like or dislike. It's we have a process that we call rubrics where we design before a course how we're going to evaluate the coursework.
Yes,
that's what we follow. We don't follow whether we like Richard or don't like Richard. And that is totally a
subject of that.
Well, quite often I'll look at papers and I will hide the name of the person who's writing it. I'll ask students to turn in a paper and put their name on the back side of the last page so I don't know who's wrote it.
So now I'll be in that position.
Okay.
So it's your best advice, my assumption, okay, going underneath it, which we didn't talk about the paratrooper thing, is that what you're teaching the teachers that look, now, what you're about to see is a group of people just ain't the best of them, ain't normal. So, and people are different.
That's good.
Right. Except that he reaches the back.
That flies in the face of most academia where we teach in the middle.
That makes
entrepreneurship. We don't teach the middle, we teach to the individual.
It's
teach the fines of the bell curve.
Well, we teach the individual wherever they are in the bell curve. So this whole program is designed around your idea of what you want to do. And your idea of what you want to do is different from everybody else's idea of what they want to do. So by the nature of the design of our curriculum, it's based on working with the individual. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have had some pretty good success. Our students have had some
success. I just wish it was slightly more hybrid. Okay? In other words, you combine the intimate with the interaction with the teacher.
Yes, we have we do not do enough interaction between the student and we understand that. But again, we're learning.
I want to go out this after the interview, okay?
Okay.
I want you to do your best. You say there's funding everywhere, but, I got to be honest with you, with the FDIC, the banks, with the Small Business Administration, always been fairly useless anyways, with the Dodd-Frank Act coming up, as
the new law they're passing now. They're just putting it through Congress now. They just passed it, as a matter of fact.
Oh,
you can get up to $2 million of funding without having to go to the SEC for a stock offer. This is new stuff they're getting around. I mean, there's no question that the Dodd-Frank and the Dole, they put some onerous regulations on small businesses.
The grant system is pathetic because we ourselves have a smoking gun cylinder, which was turned down that grant at the same time because we did not have a crony up there. We have a smoking gun. But you know what? That's not part of this. Andrew, you are deviating from the executive pass, and normally it's my job to be all over the place. I'm not going to allow this.
This is certainly right. You can even wash my pet a little bit.
You know your strengths. I'm not going to go over the best. Your best advice to incoming entrepreneurs in three sentences.
If you have a good idea that you believe in, don't end up in your 60s and 70s regretting that you didn't do it.
Now let's go back. I'd like you to rate your advice regarding, this is serious stuff, the current business climate.
Well, I think that there are as many opportunities today as there have ever been. Okay, so
I do agree with that.
And I think that there's no dearth of ideas about solving a lot of the problems. The creativity that you need to have is how you're going to get your idea funded if you can. And there are an awful lot of people in this country that have a lot of balls. They earned it as entrepreneurs, and they're approachable. If you have a good idea, you just need to figure out how to network your way into them.
I think that might be a great service at the university in defining and enabling connections between forms.
Maybe.
Well, most of it.
I mean, one of the things I know about selling an investment idea.
I didn't talk about the selling of the investment idea. I talked about the identification, okay? And
identification of what?
Of the sources of capital, an appropriate use of time in the connection of the source of capital to the type of business.
Okay.
Okay. Utilizing your entrepreneurial skill set. How are we going to survive the current economic climate? Do you have any solutions? And of course, how are you currently impacted?
Well, I'm in the riskiest job I've ever had.
Yeah.
There's been one job I've ever had. But from a purely monetary point of view, this is not very lucrative, quite frankly. But that's not why I did it. And how we will survive the. I'm so happy that we have the Occupy Wall Street group up and going. I'm happy the Tea Party's up and going. We are finally getting a dialogue. The country has been here before with a bunch of inept people in Washington, and we'll end up getting rid of most of them and getting people who are serious thinkers about solving our country's problems. This country is a pendulum, and we got way out of whack. And now I think it'll come back.
Well, this concept that 80% of the businesses fail and 20% succeed is such a misnomer. And because the 20% that succeed is so far overwhelmed in jobs and productivity and money, the 80%, well, but also understand, I've had a bunch of companies that I started that I closed down. That's part of the 80%. You've got to really dig into the statistics to understand what's going on.
Right.
But
the odds are not that great to having a startup business become sustainable and exceptionally growing to an exceptionally large company. But we have a lot of examples of that did it. And if there's any place in the world where you're going to have a chance to do it, this is it. And I have abiding faith in the environment in the United States where you can do it again.
Well, isn't it the case that we must do it? Because the only way that America can prosper again lies within the ability. I mean, those people on that wall who signed that Declaration of Independence, what proportion of them were entrepreneurs?
Almost all of them.
Almost all of them. Okay? And in the culture of the freedom to succeed rather than the hierarchical inbredness of royalty, etc., isn't that our advantage over labor costs?
Sure. We did it. And if you remember back when Bill Clinton was the president, we were hand-wringing because we had such a huge deficit. And they slowed down spending, they increased the taxes, the economy prospered, we're on our way out of the problem. The same thing is going to happen again. It's tougher because we've dug ourselves a huge hole. I mean, one of the severe criticisms I have of the United States is we are historically the greatest warmongering country in the world. We need to get away from trying to do that.
We had a free wars by the current administration saying four sentences to the Iranians when they were uprising as the Greens said, if you keep hurting the people, you're going to be messing with us. It was just four sentences that needed to be said. It wasn't, they didn't need to raise a gun.
But you need to go, there's a historical relationship back in the 50s when the Shah was there and all of the things we did. You've got to understand the history.
Mistakes.
Yeah. And we believe, that John Foster Dulles and the domino theory is always all predicated that we knew better than anybody else how to run the country. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. We've got to become, I'm glad that China has risen, is rising up. So we have to learn to be a member of the community of nations. We are not the dominant. We'll tell you how to do things, country.
Well, we need to learn to make more customers.
The other big mistake we made in this country is we stopped making things back in the 50s, late 50s and 60s. And we started outsourcing and doing service industry. And then we let our expectations, life was easy in the 80s and 90s. So we've become
by teaming with entrepreneurs, but making unions entrepreneurs. That America should be not 9% manufacturing, but 25%
and more.
And now we come to the end of. I don't know how to make it to his resume, but he's very generous in his ability, his allowing me to interview him. And by his classes, his interviews should not be singular, should not simply be posted, but there are gems in these interviews that must be passed on. And I knew that interviewing Dr. Frank Lockwood, and I don't put apples with teachers, okay, would be the greatest final interview. And I'm really grateful to you, Dr. Lockwood, not just for giving me the interview, but for being who you are. Okay, and for creating what you've done. Now, Dr. Lockwood will not accept compliments, okay? And it'll be very difficult for him. But we all know that he's the driving force between the entrepreneurial department, the entrepreneurial department of Western County University. And so we've got the honor for that. Thanks so much for letting us into your home.
That was fun.
Now, let me tell you what you do.
Okay, Dawn, that's ready.
You can just stay there for a little while.
Well, no, I can't. We should send it. I mean, what you know. Tomorrow? Well...